Hello, it's Monday, July the 26th. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we're talking about makeup for men. Well, would you wear it if you're a fella? I wear it professionally if I'm doing TV, but I wouldn't wear it socially. Also, why the pandemic has created a huge upsurge in domestic violence. Dementia, the number of cases up to 50,000 that have been missed during lockdown. And the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, has apologised for suggesting we shouldn't cower in the face of COVID. Why did he need to apologise for that? It's the front page of the Daily Mail today. Up to 50,000 dementia cases have been missed during lockdown. It means 1 in 10 new sufferers went undiagnosed because GPs were told not to refer patients to specialist memory clinics during the first lockdown. Experts warn this could place greater pressure on frontline services in future as undiagnosed sufferers seek help. James White is Head of Public Affairs and Campaigns at the Alzheimer's Society and joins me now. James, very troubling, isn't it? These figures are very troubling.
Yeah, we're extremely worried, Andrew. Throughout the pandemic, people with dementia have been worst hit. But to obviously learn of this backlog of tens of thousands of people, being effectively left in the dark about the nature of their condition is really worrying. Getting a diagnosis is so important. It allows people to get access to services that without that diagnosis they simply can't get. So it's why it's so worrying to hear about this and so urgent that action is taken to address it.
And I'm just thinking about, it's probably a bit of a stereotype, James, but you're thinking about perhaps an older couple, maybe in their 70s. He's worried about his wife or she's worried about her husband because she thinks he's getting very forgetful or the other way around. What sort of services would they have access to if they were able to get that diagnosis?
Well, that's right. So I think to take that example that you talked about, indeed for anybody that is concerned about their memory, and they should go and seek help from their GP, because if you then get that referral to kind of specialist service, a memory clinic, then people can start to understand the true nature of their condition, which may indeed be ruling out dementia. But once people understand the nature of their condition, then obviously the treatment program that can be put in place is the right one for them. But of course, without going to that GP and then getting that referral on, then none of those things happen, which again means that couple that you alluded to, they're left none the wiser, which is a situation that none of us would want to be in for us or indeed our loved ones.
Yeah, and of course, even now, James, it can be a problem because I'm not sure that GPs are seeing everybody face to face. There's still a lot of online appointments, and can it be as effective in your view an online appointment?
So obviously with the pandemic, a lot of innovation happened in a lot of fields, including increased use of online consultations.
Yeah,
I think it varies according to individuals, so it wouldn't be right to kind of say definitively, but I think to your point about things getting back to normal, it is a slow process. We look at the figures when they come out every month, and we've seen that the diagnosis rate is going up, but we're talking a kind of a 0.1% increase each month from March to the latest figures that we had. So that suggests that there is still a lot more to be done, and there has been some money that has been promised to try and address this issue, to the tune of about 17 million from the government. But we want to be clearer about how that money is being invested and making sure it's been targeted. Yeah, so where the most people that are in need of that support are getting the maximum benefit.
I mean, it's easy to bandy figures around, James, because the country's in so much debt now because of this pandemic. But when you think we're £1.5 trillion in debt now, 70 million doesn't sound a lot when you consider nearly 450,000 dementia cases are missed. That figure could, of course, be a lot higher.
Well, this is it. Dementia is a condition. There's 850,000 people with dementia right now. That figure's going to increase. The diagnosis rates are really just the tip of the iceberg. We're concerned about the whole package to do with rehabilitation. It's not just diagnosis services that have stopped, but you know, those ongoing treatments that people would have had have in many cases ground to a halt because of the pandemic. So we are very concerned about what's coming. You know, there isn't, as we speak here today, anything like a national rehabilitation strategy in place for dementia and other long-term conditions. So we really think that that does need to be addressed as a matter of some urgency, because it's having nearly a million people not getting the support that they need would be a continuing tragedy after what's been a very difficult 18 months.
Just finally, James, what is your advice to people who will be listening to this podcast, who maybe it's a son or a daughter or a relative or even a friend who's worried about an older person and they think is in difficulty and they haven't been able to see a doctor? Maybe they've been isolating anyway. What's your advice to them? What should they do?
Sure, I would reiterate, I think it's important for people to contact their GP. But Alzheimer's Society, you know, we have a Dementia Connect support line, which people can ring up. And obviously our website, which is alzheimers.org.uk, is a great source of information and advice for people. I mean, there are many other charities as well that will provide that guidance and, you know, signpost people towards where they can get the help and the answers, really, that I think people are often striving for.
Okay, so let's just get that website right. So it's alzheimers.org.uk. And do you want to tell us the helpline number too?
Of course. So it's our Dementia Connect support line, and that's 0333 150 3456.
All right, great to talk to you. That's James White. He's Head of Public Affairs and Campaigns at Alzheimer's Society. Thanks for joining us. You can visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. Sajid Javid has apologised after tweeting that Britain should no longer be cowering from COVID-19. MPs and campaigners accused the new health secretary of being insensitive to the families of those who have died of the virus and those who are seriously ill with the virus. Mr. Javid has since deleted the tweet. I'm joined now by Lobby Akinola, who's a spokesman for Bereaved Families for Justice, one of the groups who's criticised Mr. Javid. Lobby, if I can use your first name, he's just come out of isolation. He'd gone down with COVID. And we know what he was trying to say, that we've got to learn to live with this disease. Do you think the language he used was unfortunate?
Yes, I think it is unfortunate, the language that he used. I understand the sentiment that the health secretary was trying to, you know, send across. But I think it's just, especially for something such a sensitive subject for so many people, extra care has to be taken in the language that was used. And we appreciate that he's apologised. But, you know, it's definitely something that would have caused a lot of pain, a lot of trauma for many people across the country. So, you know, it's very unfortunate that he used that language.
Yeah, I mean, we know what he was trying to do. He was trying to say, we've got to stand up to it. We've lived with it for a long time. We've got to live with it. Do you think some people also associated the word cower with cowardly? Because I heard someone on the radio saying it was almost as he's implying that people who've had COVID or people who've died of COVID hadn't been brave enough, which would have been a pretty awful interpretation if that's what people were thinking.
I do think that when you hear the word cower, it does paint a picture of, you know, someone potentially like pulling back or hiding away from something. And that's why it's such an unfortunate use of language.
Yeah.
You know, people who have been affected by COVID, people who have lost their lives, like you said, it's not as a result of bravery, and it's not from lack of fight.
Yeah.
It's not that they didn't, you know, do their best to protect themselves, but it's, you know, this is a sad reality of this virus, that we lose people and there are long-term effects with people's lives. And that's why it is so important to get the messaging correct around this virus and how we respond to it. Because if there's one thing that's been clear that throughout this pandemic is, you know, public morality and people's trust and appreciation in the leadership has an important role to play in how we respond and, you know, adhere to rules and follow the advice and guidelines that's given to us.
Do you think there's also a sense, Lobby, that because we've had this, we've been living with this pandemic for 15 months, because the death toll is up there, nearly 130,000 now, we've almost become, there's almost a sense of fatigue now when we hear the death toll 43 people died in the last 24 hours. People shrug, and it's almost as if it's just an everyday event, and the shock effect has long since passed away.
I would say that there is, on a national scale, I think there is some feeling of fatigue. You know, yeah. Even as someone who's been bereaved by this pandemic, it's hard every day to, you know, hear these numbers. You can't imagine that. You can't really see the significance of that because it's such a big number. I can't imagine 120, 130,000 people.
No, it's a town, isn't it? It's the size of a town.
Yeah. It's a town just disappeared, but I think that's like why it's so important to, you know, have these personal experiences, people's personal stories as part of the narrative, because it's easy to distance yourself and not really consider the humanity of that scale of loss. But when we see these very personal single examples, everyone can relate to the feeling of losing a loved one. Everyone knows the fear of that. And I think that's why it's so important. And that also plays a role in the way we tell our stories, because it's sadly, like, we still have the pandemic in this country. You know, since June, we fortunately had at the start of June a day where there was zero COVID deaths. But since then, over 1,000 people have died. And yeah. In the grand scale of things, because so many people have unfortunately been lost, I don't think it hits home as much as it would do had you heard that news. You know, before COVID, if someone said 1,000 people have died in 2 months, that would be...
Yes, that's right. That's what I mean. I think we have become almost fatigued to it. Just finally, Lobby, there'll be a public inquiry, of course, into the way the government conducted its response to COVID, which starts next April. You represent families that have been bereaved. How distressed are they that they're going to have to wait for so long to get some answers?
I think it is. It's very distressing. It's there's a fear. There's definitely a fear and a worry that, you know, it's not just the waiting for answers. It's waiting for the information and tools we can use to defend ourselves. Because the point of this inquiry is, yes, we understand what went wrong, but we'll also therefore know how we can address and fix them. No one wants to go into a perpetual cycle of lockdowns. No one wants to live like that. And it's just this idea, like I said, you know, we've gone from at what point being like, no one's dying anymore, to people are dying again. And I think it's that idea of there's no reason to wait, or at least we haven't seen a reason to wait to start this inquiry, because every day, every minute that these informations, these stories, these answers aren't being found is risking people's lives. And I think that's what's driving the group, and that's what's driving the push for the inquiry to start now. So we're very happy that an inquiry is going to start and that it's going to happen. But time is and always has been of the essence. So ideally, we'd want it to start as soon as humanly possible.
All right, that's Lobby Akinola. He's spokesman for Bereaved Families for Justice, one of the groups who criticised Sajid Javid. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. A report by the Office for National Statistics has revealed how the pandemic has affected the nation's crime rate. And guess what? It's gone up. The report covers the year up to March 21st. And while it reveals reductions in crimes such as robbery, it so shows significant increases in online fraud. But also, sadly, reports of domestic abuse have increased during the pandemic. Lisa King is Director of Communications and External Relations for Refuge, which is a charity campaigning against domestic violence and to help the victims of domestic violence. Lisa, I suppose there was something horribly inevitable about this. More people trapped, if trapped is the right word, stuck at home, in closed spaces, maybe no outside space, always puts pressure on relationships that may be under pressure already, puts them under even more pressure.
Andrew, you're absolutely right. Lockdown, in its whole purpose, is a big challenge for women experiencing domestic abuse. Of course, there have been those critical moments last year when we haven't been able to leave our homes. We're very much kind of living in one space, unable to access support or, you know, any groups or the GP or any such resources. And being at home with a perpetrator would sadly have certainly exacerbated pre-existing behaviours and worsened that experience for many hundreds of thousands of women up and down the country today.
The trouble here often is, Lisa, of course, the pressure points which can trigger domestic abuse were ongoing because this lockdown has been so protracted so long. Then we get lifted out of lockdown, back in it we go. Have you been given sufficient resources, in your view, to tackle it and to help the victims?
We have, and you had some additional resources during the pandemic, particularly to support Refuge's National Domestic Abuse Helpline, which runs every hour of every day to support women who need us. But that funding has been quite limited, and it has been emergency funding, and it's all come to an end now. But of course, we are still seeing, and sadly so, a huge increase in calls and contacts across our helpline services, even though we're out of lockdown now, as women are able and increasingly in a position to reach out and access support.
The Office for National Statistics say, and perhaps you can explain this, they say it's difficult to determine the levels of domestic abuse in the country using police recorded data because of changes in the way the crime are reported. Now, who's changed the way the crimes are reported? And has the result of that been, in your view, that less domestic abuse is reported?
We have never in this country had clarity over domestic abuse statistics. And that essentially is because so little domestic abuse is actually reported to the police. So even the figures that we look at are shocking and huge. They are really what we would imagine at Refuge as the tip of the iceberg. Around a quarter of domestic abuse is only ever reported to the police. So you can see that the very large majority of incidents are being experienced behind closed doors and are not being collated and created as data anywhere.
It's pretty scary because the police say they recorded 845,000 offences, which they recorded as domestic abuse. But if you're saying probably only a quarter of those are ever reported to the police, that shows that actually we're closer to over 3.5-4 million offences.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, there are layer on top of that, all those people who don't actually identify their experience as domestic abuse. Most people experience and recognise domestic abuse as something physical, like broken bones or black eyes. They don't really understand and look broader than that to the huge gamut and ways of controlling another person. And that control can be, you know, financial, sexual, psychological. So really, our basic kind of identifying way of encouraging people to understand domestic abuse is to say that if you are changing your behavior in any way because you're scared of your partner's reaction, that's domestic abuse. And I sadly think that if more people had an understanding of the full gamut of domestic abuse, the figures would be off the scale.
And domestic abuse, coercive behaviour is, in your view, Lisa, domestic abuse?
Absolutely. If you are coerced to making a decision or a choice that you don't want to make, that you are forced to make because you're frightened of your partner's reaction, if you don't make that choice, that is coercion. That is domestic abuse, and that is against the law.
If I could ask you just finally, what's your advice maybe to perhaps some teenagers living at home and they regularly see abuse is being heaped on their mum by the partner, and mum isn't doing anything about it because she's either too scared or doesn't want to bring the police or people like Refuge into their homes? What's your advice to those teenagers? Do they shop the bloke who's beating the hell out of mum or abusing mum or not?
I think every situation is so very individual and difficult to determine from a kind of, a generic standpoint. I would urge any young person who is witnessing and experiencing domestic abuse to call the NSPCC or Barnardo's. We primarily have a helpline set up for women, but if any child did call us, then we would support them and refer them on to charities that could help. But nobody should suffer in silence, and children should know that they are not alone and that there is support available to them. But to also understand that domestic abuse is a life and death issue, and we would encourage a young person not to intervene directly.
So, Lisa, thank you. That's very good advice. So if people wanted to call Refuge or look at your website, how do they do that?
Our helpline runs every hour of every day. It is a busy service, but do try. And that number is 0808 2000 247. Or do visit our helpline website, which is nationaldahelpline.org.uk, where there's a web form and you can book a time when it's safe for us to call you, or there's a live chat service where our experts are there to support women every Monday to Friday, 3 p.m. till 10 p.m.
That's Lisa King. She's Director of Communications and External Relations for Refuge, the charity campaigning against domestic violence.
A huge sports week, so thrilled to have with us in the studio Matt Scaphood, who is, of course, the Deputy Sports Editor. So, a bit of a gold rush, Matt, in Tokyo.
Indeed, yeah, our first gold medal. So, overnight, PT won gold, closely followed by, it all happened very quickly, a bit of a blur of gold for Team GB. So, PT started it.
And he's the first British swimmer to defend an Olympic title in the swimming pool.
Yeah, I mean, he's an absolute phenomenon. I mean, he crushes his rivals.
Amazing. He's built like a...
He's incredible, yeah.
The build of the man.
Yeah, I mean, his shoulders and his chest, the width of his chest, and he's just got such strength, such power. That I think his rivals pretty much know he's won before he gets in the pool. You know, he's such a strong favourite for this. And he was interesting talking afterwards about saying how, you know, he was going into this race knowing that he was expected to win, which he wasn't so much in Rio when he won his other last gold medal.
It was 100 metres, wasn't it?
100 metres breaststroke,
And does he go for gold in the 200 metres breaststroke?
No, so now he's the only races he's got left now are relay races, so he's reliant upon others. But he is talking about, you know, he'll do it again in come Paris in 4 years' time. Yeah. But he's 26. Just absolutely destroyed the field. I mean, he has the 17 fastest times in this race. You know, he has the top 17. Yeah. He's just incredible.
Yeah.
So his eventual time is the fifth fastest ever. So the fifth fastest ever time. As I say, he owns the 17 best times at that race.
Amazing.
His PB, you know, when we're talking about 56, 57, 58 seconds here, so we're not talking about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
His PB is a second faster than anyone else has ever swum that distance. So
it's huge. And he seems such a nice bloke too. He's just had a little boy, hasn't he?
He's had a little boy who we credited with giving him the determination and the motivation to go on to do it.
And then Tom Daley's finally won gold at his third Olympics. That's terrific. I mean, he's pretty much an old man for a diver, isn't he? At 27.
He is. Yeah, 27. So he's been diving for 20 years. And, you know, he thought probably his chance had gone, really.
Yes.
He would have said that Rio was his best chance of a gold.
And he got silver at that, didn't
he? Yeah, he got silver. So, and finally he's got he won bronze at Bronze London and Rio.
Right.
So he had two bronzes and he thought his best chance of gold had gone at Rio. And now finally gets his, and he's had a pretty bad build-up as well. He's had injuries over the last few years, had a knee surgery not so long ago. So he would have thought, you know, it wasn't going to happen for him.
And he did it with another guy who's his best mate, apparently.
He's his best mate who used to be about 4 year age gap. So this kid's about 22, 23.
Right.
He's used to be, you know, Daley used to be his hero, and now they're best mates.
How amazing.
They didn't, and now they dive together, and now they've won gold. So it's a really lovely story with Tom
Daley.
Very
good. And then the other one was it something to do with biking, cross country, something?
So then we have the mountain biker.
A mountain biker,
a guy called Tom Pidcock who won gold, and again he was superb. I mean, the margin of victory for Daley was tiny as opposed to Petey, but Pidcock was another one who won comfortably. So he's 21. Now you're going to hear a lot more about this guy. There's talk about him turning to racing and things like the Tour de France. He's such a professional on a bike. He's so good on a bike that they think that he can turn his hand to a lot of the different disciplines in cycling. So he eventually, it's 1 hour 25, he's going around this treacherous course. I don't know if you saw any of it, but I mean, you're going downhill.
I haven't seen any of the Olympics yet.
Oh, well, I will watch.
I get excited.
I get excited
with the athletics. But
right.
I was at a really early breakfast day with an MP, so I would have known about, so I didn't know about the Tom Daley until I got into the office.
Right.
But I was thrilled for him.
Oh, it's crazy, all these, you know.
And I would be frightened to jump off
I know.
Ball.
I know.
I bought that high, and they do it together, precision. Yeah.
I want to know who thinks of these things. I know. You know, not just one person dying. Well, why don't we get another person up there with you?
I know.
And you've got to do it in sync. I mean, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And so the mountain biker, you know, someone crashed just in front of him in the early stages of the race. He managed to avoid them. And, you know, you've got all these sort of obstacles. Obviously, the worst thing that could happen is a puncture. So you've got to sort of make sure that, you know, as best you can, manipulate where your bike's landing at and et cetera, et cetera. And he won by a full 20 seconds in the end. So he won quite comfortably, grabbed a Union Jack flag as he went over the line, and one for the future, well, one for now, but also one to we'll hear a lot more about him.
So we're in the top six or seven now in the medals table.
Must be in the top five, and we just missed out on another gold.
Did we?
So in the Taekwondo final, Lauren Williams, who's a 22-year-old from Wales, she just lost in the final in heartbreaking fashion. She was leading until the final few seconds.
Like the British guy yesterday,
exactly,
getting the silver. He said he wasn't going to celebrate the silver because he was winning. It was gold until the last 8 seconds.
I know.
He's got to celebrate the silver. But he's the world champ, isn't
exactly.
he? So he expected to get gold.
Exactly. He had his heart set on gold. His coach said to him, second is nothing almost, didn't he? So that's going to be a tough one. And it was going to be equally tough for this Lauren Williams girl who looked like she had it in the bag as well and then just got caught towards the end.
I've never heard of Taekwondo till the Olympic Games. I mean, it's some form of martial art.
Yeah. No, well, I've heard of it. I mean, it's pretty popular, I think.
Yeah, we're obviously very good at it in Britain.
We are. We've got a very strong team,
And then, so we're doing very well. And then I'm going to have to teach you about this, Matt. The rugby, you told me last week the Lions were going to get squeezed out by South Africa and they were going to lose. And I said, right, down the bookies, money on the Lions team.
Exactly, bit of reverse psychology for
well
you.
Well done.
I knew you were going to head down the bookies. Yeah. I didn't want you to waste your money.
It was a good game, was it?
It was a good second half.
But it was close, which is what you said it would be.
Yeah, it was a very good second half. The first half was fairly dry, to be honest. There wasn't a great deal of incident. Then the second half came to life. Lions scored an early try. Then the South Africans seemed to tire, to be honest. I mean, you've got to remember with South Africa, they haven't really played a meaningful test match since the World Cup because of COVID, which is 18 months ago.
Because they're the world champions, aren't they?
They're the world champions. They beat England in the World Cup final.
Yeah.
But they haven't had much rugby. And it seemed like in the last... half an hour or so, 20 minutes certainly, they seemed to tire and the Lions got better and better. And the Lions players who came off the bench improved the Lions, whereas the South African replacements didn't have the same impact. So in the end, it was you know, a close scoreline. But in the end, Lions would say they won it with a little bit of breathing space.
Right.
But you never know if something crazy could have happened at the end. But a great win.
Great start. That's the deputy sports editor, Matt Gatwood, who I think is going to be with us probably just about every day this week. And is it 2 weeks, the Olympics?
It's 2 weeks. So we've got a week and a half.
Looking forward to it. Apparently, 1 in 20 British men now wear makeup. That's according to a recent survey. And this weekend, the UK's first store dedicated solely to selling slap for men has opened on London's Carnaby Street. The Mail sent sketch writer Henry Dees to try it out, and he joins me now. Henry, you're a very entertaining piece, but why are you still wearing it 3 days later?
Is it that obvious?
Yeah, you haven't wiped it off. You just can't bear to.
It came off that evening, though I was given a nice little goodie bag to take away from me. I haven't opened it yet, but there may come a morning where I'm due an editorial conference and it might come in handy.
What if you're looking a bit hungover and puffy-eyed?
I said in the piece, it's a bit unfair. Women have this advantage over us when they have their sort of late Sunday nights and during at work. You know, you whack on a bit of concealer, put a, you know, foundation. Whereas us men, we have to sort of, you know, just sit there, grin and bear it.
So in the world of TV, which I'm in quite a lot, Henry, I often have to do have my own brushes because of COVID. So was it a COVID-friendly makeup session you had?
Yes. I mean, you have to keep your distance a little bit. And obviously there's a bit of sanitising goes on. But you know what? I'm double jabbed. I wasn't too fussed about it.
No. So tell us what they did to you.
Started off with something called a primer, which for years I've read the word primer in women's magazines and never known exactly what it is. I now know it is effectively that's your sort of base level.
Yeah.
Fills in all the things, puts the thing.
Yeah.
And then I had this thing which basically tinted moisturiser. It was a moisturiser with this sort of foundation in it. And it just evened it. It wasn't dramatic. I sort of came away worried I was going to look like Donald Trump, but it wasn't a very dramatic overhaul. It just sort of, you know, just evened all the inconsistencies out.
So would people, when you got on the tube after, I mean, how long were you in the session for? Was it 40 minutes?
Well, I had to do, yes, I was there about 40 minutes, but the actual so-called transformation probably took no more than 10 minutes.
Yeah. But did you notice people looking on the tube thinking, that bloke's got makeup
on? No, I was worried about that. And I got back to the office and some of the girls in the office all came up and stuff and they hadn't noticed until I told them, which is a good thing.
It is actually, yeah. Would it have worked if you'd had this heavy morning stubble, which you've got on your face at the moment?
No.
Could you wear makeup with stubble?
You can, because this is where you need men's products.
Yeah.
He put this stuff on and I hadn't actually shaved that morning.
Right.
And if it had been a women's product, it would have been too heavy. So it would have I would have then walked away with a sort of orange beard.
What about women then who've got a bit of stubble? How do they manage with that? Some women do have stubble. I've seen it.
They probably have to just get the products that suit them.
Okay. How much would it have cost you to buy the products?
It's not cheap. I would say I was sweetly given a goodie bag, but I would imagine you're probably looking at sort of, you know, 50, 60 quid for, you know, the simple sort of
stuff. How long would that stuff last you?
Oh, that'd last you
couple
3 or 4
months
or something. Yeah,
yeah. Are you going to do it again?
As I said, I'm keeping it as my emergency supply if needed.
And was he wearing makeup, the chap?
Yes,
who,
he's worn it every single day since he was 14.
14. He's called Danny Gray, and of course it's called War Paint, the company, isn't it?
War Paint, which, if you're going to make a sort of manly product, I think it was quite a good name. He has worn it every day since he's 14. He developed spots when he was young,
so did I.
Got bullied.
Yeah.
And he discovered in his sister's makeup bag all sorts of these unguents that suddenly changed his life, and it helped him redevelop his confidence.
Yeah, well, acne is a really bad thing. I had it really badly until I was about 24, 25.
And that's terrible.
It was terrible, and I was a young reporter going off to interview local mayors and MPs or visiting government ministers, and I just felt so self-conscious that my face was a sea of red spots.
That must be awful. That is exactly the inspiration for this business. He wants to help people sort of rediscover confidence.
Yeah, and I always thought, though, that makeup might make it worse.
Back then, it probably would have done.
Yeah,
I think it's all got a bit more high-tech since then.
And was his makeup obvious, Danny's, or not?
No, it wasn't. Though he was sort of one of those people that, as you can imagine, looks after his appearance very well, so it didn't surprise me.
Didn't he turn down some money from Dragon's Den?
He was offered £70,000 by the Dragon's Den. They all bit their hands off, and it was, lots of people say it was one of the most sort of the best episodes of the series, and it was one of those things where they all immediately got it. Presumably, being TV people like yourself as well, they realised that
make it very important.
There would be a market for it.
Yeah. So he didn't. So he and he didn't need the money because didn't he put his products in John Lewis to start with?
He got it on John Lewis. He got it into lots of shops. I think his first month he predicted £2,000 worth of sales when he launched these products, and he got 11,000. That just kept quadrupling over each month. So
I might go and see him. Do you think he could do anything for me?
I think he could do wonders for you, Piercy.
All right, that's lovely, Henry Deeds, our parliamentary sketch writer. Makeup for men. It's called War Paint. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.